Dave and it's sports.
All right, welcome to the Steve Cochran Everything Podcast. Very special guest today. It's tough to book this guy. Dave Ennett's here. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing great, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Now, we're going to talk about basketball because it's that time of year.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go backwards for a second. Let's go all the way back to when you were but a boy in Washington, D.C. What is your first sports memory?
My first sports memory is going to Washington Senators opening day. And I was probably, I don't know, 6-7 years old.
Okay.
At old, and back then it was DC Stadium. It wasn't even RFK Stadium.
Okay. Yet.
And that was the presidential opener. So they would bring the president, more often than not, would show up and throw out the first pitch, and it was a big deal.
So was that Taft?
No, it was Teddy. That? It was Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt throughout the first pitch. Yes.
I don't remember seeing, and we have a picture here at the station of John F. Kennedy at the presidential opener being interviewed by Vince Lloyd from WGN
right
before the game, and LBJ is standing to his side. I don't remember being there. I think I was, and whether or not I was at an opener when he was president, I probably was. The first president I remember being there was Nixon, and I was always sort of the opinion that they ought to just get on with the game because I'm ready to play the game.
Right, you were there.
We
for
don't
the
need all this other stuff going on.
All this balderdash,
yeah.
Hoo ha.
Yeah.
Were you into a particular sport as a kid?
I think the basics. I mean, baseball and football were my sports. I mean, I loved baseball from the time I was a little kid, even though I never saw a good team in the city where I grew up. I mean, it was pretty bleak. I was very young when they moved the original Washington Senators out of town to Minnesota. They became the Twins.
Oh, that's right.
And then I was in high school when they moved the second iteration of the Washington Senators to Texas, and they became the Rangers.
You know, the first baseball game I ever went to was a Washington Senators Baltimore Orioles doubleheader.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, maybe. And my family and I drove down from upstate New York, probably a 6, 7 hour drive. And my father never drove more than 40 miles an hour, so it took about 3 weeks to get there. And I remember walking in, and the grass was never greener. It was that amazing, amazing experience. But Ted Williams was the manager of the Senators. And if I remember right, he's a really bad manager.
Well, actually, his first year, he was pretty good.
Oh, was he?
His first year was 1969. And he
yeah, this would have been 70, probably 70, 71.
Yeah, they didn't hang around very long. And in fact, I think 71 was their last season. 71 or 72 was their last season in Washington. But 69, they finished, I think, 10 games over 500, which by their standards was like going to the postseason.
It's huge.
It was huge. He was American League Manager of the Year. And
am I remembering this right? Frank Howard?
The Washington Monument.
Would Frank have been the Howard. First baseman?
He was... first base, left field,
mm-hmm.
wore number 33, massive guy.
What I remember specifically was Frank Howard and Boog Powell.
Mm-hmm.
Boog Powell was the Baltimore Orioles first baseman. Those two guys standing next to each other were like giants.
They were. They both wore the very short sleeves.
Showing off their guns.
Showing off the guns, and both hit the ball a ton.
Right.
And you know, that Baltimore team, you had Boog Powell, you had, of course, Brooks and Frank Robinson.
Well, they were my team.
Oh, sure.
So you had Manny Sanguin or Andy Etchebarren was pitching.
Mm-hmm.
You had that amazing pitching staff.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody liked Jim Palmer, but, mm-hmm. you know, you had Dave McNally.
Cuellar.
And Cuellar, a bunch of guys.
Pat Dobson.
But Brooks at third.
Mm-hmm.
Shortstop would have been...
Well, if you go back a few years, well, this would have been the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Earl Weaver was the manager.
Earl Weaver was managing. You had, let's see, you had Don Buford was in the outfield.
Paul Blair.
Frank Robinson.
But I can't remember second and short.
I'm blanking on it right now,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. But anyway, it's a great team.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great team. But a doubleheader, 85 cents. Super Joe, look that up for me, will you? Who are the second baseman and shortstops for the 1970-71 Baltimore?
Well, one was Mark Belanger.
Oh, Belanger was a shortstop.
Belanger was at short. Okay, this is, and Dave Johnson was the second baseman.
Davey Johnson, of course. Yeah. Turned out to be a pretty good manager.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Who was your first sports caster that you remember?
There was a guy in Washington who went on to become pretty well known nationally, Warner Wolf.
Oh, sure.
Everybody watched Warner Wolf. He was the first of the kind of local sportscasters, at least in that area, who really kind of had a breakout gimmick. And he would go to highlights. He's, let's go to the videotape. And he would do a boo of the week where he would just a bad play or a guy who had done something wrong or something. And so he brought a lot of personality to it, and he was pretty popular back then.
And he went on to New York City.
Went to New York, eventually he was on Monday Night Baseball on ABC for a while, and then he went back and did local TV in New York for a long time and was on with Imus
forever
up until just a few years ago.
And he's still alive.
Oh, yeah.
He's
he just got
around.
Into trouble a couple
he
weeks
did.
Ago.
I don't remember what it was, but he got into trouble with somebody. It was with a cop,
something,
was it?
No, it was defacing a sign, which he took exception to in his place in Florida.
That was it.
Right?
That was
it.
It was retirement community.
Said, but yeah.
All right. So what about college sports? When do you remember paying attention to any college sports?
You know, I honestly remember watching Maryland basketball, which was big when I was growing up, with Lefty Driesell.
Yeah.
And in the ACC, and they had great battles with North Carolina back then and Virginia and it's interesting because my dad was a Georgetown alum. Georgetown had not yet hit its golden era with John Thompson. That came later. But so Maryland basketball was big. I followed that. Didn't really follow any local college football then. I mean, Maryland played, but they weren't very good, and there wasn't college football in the East.
Wasn't a lot to latch on to.
You know, unless you were at Penn State or you know, in Pennsylvania or possibly.
Well, you must remember the Coach Wooden days, the UCLA run.
Sure.
Because my first college sports memory was Digger and Notre Dame stopping the Coach Wooden run.
Right, with Austin Carr.
Yep.
And the 88-game winning streak coming to an end. And yeah, I have vivid memories of that, yeah. But, I mean, just in terms of following a particular team, I don't know that there was one I was really latched on
to. See, I don't know if you know this. I wanted to be a sportscaster when I was a kid.
Well, I know you did some. You did some hockey.
I did some early hockey, but when I was a little kid, I wanted to be a sportscaster.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just a couple years younger than you, but Cosell was the only guy that was either an ex-athlete or a straight-ahead play-by-play guy. Baseball had all the personality. You know, baseball had Harry Carey, obviously, but you had Jack Buck. You had Ernie in Detroit. You had the guy in Pittsburgh. I mean, all, you know, San Francisco had a great play-by-play guy, obviously Vin Scully. Football had a lot of straight-ahead guys. I don't remember any real light-em-up football play-by-play guys, but then the ex-players were interesting. But then you had Cosell. Cosell was the guy. Cosell was different on Monday Night Football, changed everything. But who was a mentor, not necessarily a mentor to you, who did you idolize? Who did you go, wow, this is something I want to do, and who did you think you admired the most?
Well, first of all, everybody, I think, kind of followed Cosell because he did represent that whole telling it like it is, and he was sort of a trailblazer in that sense.
Everybody sucks.
And everybody did a Howard Cosell impression, too, especially when I got to college. I mean, he was, because that was his heyday.
Sure.
He was doing Monday Night Football, was still relatively new. I was a big fan of Brent Musburger when I came to Northwestern because he was doing local TV here at Channel 2. And
oh, that was before the CBS days?
This was, well, he was doing CBS on the weekends, but he was here during the week at 6 and 10. And I remember I was working on a project at Northwestern for a class my freshman year. And so one of my classmates and I took the L down to the old CBS studios in McClurg Court.
The barn.
And the old arena, and met with Brent Musburger. And he couldn't have been more helpful or more welcoming.
Really nice
guy. And sat down with us. He was great. And a few years after that, I was working in that building for the radio station, and he would come in to do his network sportscast. And so he'd come in and just talk sports. And
who were you? Were you a kid?
Talk about life. Yeah, I was a big guy.
Hey, big guy.
Yeah,
get in there, big guy.
Yeah.
Musburger, of course, has a brother. Brother's name is Todd, who was one of the more famous agents in town.
Right.
And Brent is doing what now?
He's working, and actually, I believe it is his nephew set up this, it's called VSIN, this sports and information network in Vegas.
Is that Todd's son?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know him, but they set up this network with some Chicago guys, and Brent is the face of the network. And look, he's never, I guess, hidden his affinity for gambling, and he's always been pretty upfront on broadcasts about referring to point spreads, which in the climate today, I think you're hearing more and more of that on broadcasts. But he was one of the guys who did it. If you remember, he used to do on NFL Today the segment with Jimmy the Greek, and he'd have the pointer, and they'd go through the check marks on. They compare the two teams, offensive line, defensive line.
Right.
And they put the check marks up there. And Jimmy the Greek, they couldn't do the point spread. So Jimmy the Greek would always refer to, I like the Eagles by a little bit today.
Right. Because that was somehow on the right side of the law.
Right. But I always liked, I thought Brent was straightforward. Greg Gumbel was doing sports here at the time in Chicago, and I thought he was another guy who really just kind of told you what was going on. It wasn't a lot of just gimmicky stuff. And then Johnny Morris was also on in Chicago at the time.
Former Bear.
Yeah.
So you go to Northwestern. What were the other schools that were a possibility for you for colleges?
Well, I was all set, actually. I was going to Boston University.
Oh, you were?
I mean, there was no doubt. I mean, I had already sent them some money. I just thought they had a great communication school. I wanted to be in the business. I knew that. I had a lot of friends who were going to school in the Boston area. Being on the East Coast was more familiar territory for me, and I've told this story a bunch of times. The other school was Syracuse. I applied to Syracuse. The other school I applied to was Cornell, because I think every kid on the East Coast applies to one Ivy League school, and there was no way I was getting into Cornell. I'm not even sure why I picked Cornell, except
close.
My sister once went to Ithaca College, so I had visited Ithaca, and I thought it was a very pretty area.
Because you know I went to Ithaca College.
I do know that.
And my mom wanted me to go to Cornell, and I was offered a chance to go to Syracuse, and instead I went to Ithaca College.
There you go. But I came out, one of my best friends, I had applied to Northwestern, didn't even know much about Northwestern. The profile of the university on the East Coast, at least back then, in my circle, wasn't very high. And I didn't know much about it, but my friend's father was from Chicago and had gone to Northwestern.
Knew it was a great academic school, or didn't even know that at that point?
Oh, I knew it had a great reputation academically, and I knew it had a great journalism school. But I didn't know a whole lot beyond that. I knew they didn't have a very good football team. I'd heard.
Right.
So my friend was coming out to visit. And my parents had said, well, you can take one more visit if you want, just to make sure you want to go to Boston. And so we came out here, I think the deadline's May 1st, and we came out here in April. And
by stagecoach.
By stagecoach. Uh-huh. No, I took the train. And the Iron Horse, we called it. And I'd been to Chicago, I think, one other time. That was my sister lived here, and it was the first place I ever flew was Chicago, as a matter of fact. And so we come out here. It's a weekend in April where it is like that one weekend where it is 80 degrees and sunny
wow.
the entire weekend.
City looks beautiful.
We get to Evanston.
Lake looks amazing.
It really looks amazing. And so does the beach on the Northwestern campus mm-hmm. on an 80-degree sunny April day with every student is out there throwing frisbees around, just having a great old time. And I'm like, wait a minute. This isn't what it looked like in the guides.
Right.
You know, I didn't know it right. was going to be like this. This
Look,
is,
they have girls.
Yeah, they did. And this looks like more fun than Boston.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody's out here having a great time on the beach. So it stayed that way the entire weekend. It was unbelievable. I've been in Chicago now for 46 years. I've never seen a weekend like that since.
Not an April weekend like that?
No, and never in my 4 years at Northwestern. But it turned out that for whatever reason,
the admissions department set it up.
I guess they did. And it certainly swung me. And it turned out to be the best decision I could have made, but I didn't necessarily make it for the right reason.
Had you applied at that point?
Oh, yeah. I'd been accepted. But okay. I didn't even, like I say, I didn't know a whole lot about
Northwestern.
You must
have been a smart kid. You're a good student, huh?
But I will say this. I don't think my SAT scores, and I don't really remember what they were, but I don't think they would have gotten me in today.
Okay.
I think it's gotten tougher.
A little tougher, yeah. But I was a good test taker
mm-hmm.
and a good standardized test taker, and we had SATs on the East Coast. This is all pre-ACT
yeah,
matter.
Same here, yeah.
And but I phoned it in with classes. So I got into Syracuse. I didn't get into Cornell. The only reason I applied to Cornell is because my mom made me. but I don't think I would have gotten into Northwestern. You know, Northwestern, I knew a little bit. This is 1979 for me, and I knew Northwestern was a really good school.
Mm-hmm. I mean, by that time I was already out. So, obviously, the standards went way up at that point after I left.
But they were known for a good communication school?
Well, they were known for a good journalism school, and they had one of the things I was looking for.
That's pre-Medill, though. It wasn't called Medill.
Well, it was Medill back then.
Oh, it was.
Oh, yeah, it was. But I actually went into it was the radio, TV, film school in the School of Speech, department in the School of Speech. And they had a student radio station where some schools did, and I think now most schools have them. But back then, it was still certain schools had stations where students could actually get on the air, get a hands-on experience, and that was something I was looking for. Boston had one. Syracuse certainly had one.
The thing with Syracuse wasn't going to let you do anything until you were a junior. You had to get all your prereqs right. out of the way.
Right.
And Ithaca College was going to put me on the air right away, and I couldn't wait to get on the air. So Syracuse, there's a guy named S.I. Newhouse.
Sure.
And Newhouse Communications paid for all of Syracuse, essentially. And the Newhouse School is very famous, like the Medill School.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much everybody that's become a famous sportscaster in one way or another either went to Northwestern or went to Syracuse. And at Syracuse, I think back then, Costas was your famous alumni. But the main reason I didn't go to Syracuse was I wanted to get on the air faster than they were going to be willing to let me on the air, because the first thing I did on the air was a review of the Muppet movie, and obviously America was waiting for that.
Of course. I actually think in Northwestern, it was one of the things that appealed to me was you could do radio on the student station as a freshman.
There you go.
And I was able to do that.
Yeah, because you don't want to wait.
No, at that point, you just want to dive in and get started in the business.
All right, before you became pals with Harry and Jack and all those guys, you got to get started somewhere. What's the first thing you did on the radio?
First thing I did, aside from the student station work, was I got hired here at BBM Radio, and they hired a bunch of kids from Northwestern to come in and basically answer phones in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked from 4 to midnight, 3 or 4 nights a week, answering the phones in the newsroom, running over to the White Hen Pantry across the street and getting sandwiches for the news writers and producers and the anchor people.
You're right in the middle of it. I bet you loved it.
I loved being there.
Yeah.
I thought it was the coolest thing I could possibly be doing. And meantime, I tried to ingratiate myself as much as I could. You could use the term suck up if you want, I guess. Mm-hmm.
A different form of ingratiate.
The sports people there, and it was when I started there, it was a one-man sports department. It was Brad Palmer, who was doing both mornings and afternoon sports.
Mr. Positive, Brad Palmer.
Brad was an interesting guy. He had been in news, and he had been doing, I think, mornings, and Brad Musburger had just left. He did the afternoon sports there.
Okay.
And then he had just gone to New York full time. So Rich King was the managing editor in the newsroom, and Rich was one of the guys who hired me there.
He's only a couple years older than you.
Yeah, he's a few years older.
Yeah.
And so Rich would do the weekend afternoon sportscasts. And so the first thing I ever got to do there on the air, because I was pretty much an off-air person, but I think I filled in on a weekend afternoon for Rich doing the sportscast.
How nervous were you?
I was petrified. But I got over it pretty quickly, and it became kind of a regular fill-in gig for me. And then on my vacations, they eventually would use me as a full-time news writer.
Oh.
And so I got...
That's a good gig.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for spring break, I would stay here and do a week as a morning drive news writer or whatever. And
do you remember what you made?
I remember when I was just working in the newsroom as a phone answerer, I was making $250 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty good.
Living it.
It's pretty good.
It's $100 a week, baby.
The news writing was a union job. It was Writers Guild of America.
Oh.
I didn't get a lot, but I got a little more than I got for answering the phones.
Did you ever pay off the fact that you had to join the guild?
No, didn't come close to that. And then to be on the air, I had to join AFTRA, which is the on-air union,
for which I'm
still a member. But but when you joined it as a part-timer, even though you got a break on the dues, I didn't have a lot of money. I was a student. So it was pretty pricey for what I was being paid.
So you're now involved in the Chicago sports scene. You're a professional on some level. You get out of Northwestern. Is it safe to say Rich King gave you your first break?
He did. And John Haltman was the news director there, and John and Rich hired me. But Rich helped promote me into sports. And what happened was, and it's weird how these things work, the year that I was done at Northwestern was the year they picked up the Bears over there. So they needed production help. In more production help in sports. So I was actually full-time in news, but they were kind of shifting me into sports.
And you wanted to do sports.
Which is what I wanted.
Yeah, you wanted sports.
Which is what I wanted. And so I was the producer for the Bears broadcasts back then. And
who was doing the Bears games then?
It was Brad Palmer did the color, and Joe McConnell was the play-by-play man.
Okay, but all the stars were on WGN.
Yeah, well, they came over. Jim Finks was the general manager of the Bears, and he had been at Minnesota with the Vikings, and he had gotten to know Joe McConnell was the voice of the Vikings. So when they moved from GN, when they switched stations, obviously Jack Brickhouse wasn't switching stations, so they hired McConnell from Minnesota to come in and do the Bears.
What year was that?
It would have been 1977.
So when did GN get the Bears back? Was that the Super Bowl year?
1985, Super Bowl year.
All right, so you came over that year.
But I came over in 1984.
Oh, you did?
The year before, when the Cubs made the playoffs. And I had taken a year.
Well, look at you, you good luck charm.
I took a gap year, so to speak, because I got offered a job back in Washington, which was my hometown, and my folks still live there. And, you know, I think it was a bit of a move up for me because it was sports director at Morning Drive at the NBC station in Washington.
What was the station?
WRC.
Oh, sure.
And so, on the television side, the sports director was George Michael.
Right.
Who, the creator of the George Michael sports machine.
Right. That was ESPN before there was one.
Exactly. And he was a former top 40 DJ. Mm-hmm. In New York and Philadelphia, who had transitioned from radio into a very successful TV sportscasting
and
career.
He treated the highlights like a disc jockey, like calling, you know, talking up a record. He was talking up the highlights.
He did that, and he was terrific, and a good, really good guy too, really interesting guy. So I had the chance to go back there and work, and I thought, I might never get this chance again. So I took the job, And the day that the moving van arrived with my furniture from Chicago, we got the word that NBC was selling the station, and we were all going to be out. And I was on a one-year contract.
Oh, boy.
So it was literally the week that my contract expired was the week they closed the deal, and it was just like the last Mary Tyler Moore show where the last person out turned off the lights, and we're all gone.
Right. So you were there how long?
I was there just about a year, exactly.
Yeah, I had a few of those, as you know.
Yes.
So you come back to GN?
So after kind of twisting in the wind for a few weeks, I came back and I did a week on the air at GN as sort of an on-air audition.
Okay.
With Wally Phillips in the morning. And it was when the Cubs were in the playoffs in 1984. And they were in the postseason for the first time since 1945. They had won the National League East. And so I had this shot on the air, and they had auditioned, I think, two other people for the job. And Chuck Swirsky, who was the sports director, had lobbied on my behalf. And so I went and met with Dan Fabian, was the program director at the time.
Yeah, we love Dan.
Yeah, Dan was wonderful to me. And Lorna Gladstone, the assistant program director, and Chuck. And I remember going in a meeting with Wally in his office up at Bradley Place. And, you know, I mean, listen, I'd been in Chicago for years, and it's pretty intimidating to sit down in Wally Phillips' office knowing that, you know, if he doesn't like you, you're not getting the gig.
Yeah.
And while he couldn't have been nicer to me, he did say, all right, Ennard, let's see. Have you ever thought about changing your name? And I said, yeah, kind of, but I've been in Chicago now for a while, so I think I'm going to stick with it. And,
right.
You know, he was okay with me not accepting his advice on that. And anyway, he was great with me on the air. After my week, I went home, and then I waited for the call, and it was kind of agonizing. And finally, I got the call that I had gotten the job.
And you come back to Chicago.
And I came back to Chicago.
Now, you had one drunken moment where you went back to BBM again briefly, and then you came back to GN to stay. You've been on GN now for how long regularly?
Not consecutively now since July of 1996.
July of 96.
Yeah, so 23 years almost.
Doing Northwestern baseball and basketball and football the whole time?
Yeah, because what happened was I was started doing Northwestern football on the other station, and then that was the year in 1995. They went to the Rose Bowl, and they kind of took the college football world by storm. The Gary Barnett expect victory year in 95. They went 8-0 in the Big Ten, went to the Rose Bowl, played USC. And if not, it's funny. I was thinking about this year when the Bears lost that playoff game on the double doink.
Yeah.
If not for a field goal doinking off the upright in the fourth quarter, that they probably beat USC in the Rose Bowl and finish it a 10-1 or 9-1 season, and,
right.
And you know, as it was, well, they finished 10-3 that year, but
yeah.
They still had an unbelievable year, and of course they became a very hot commodity in Chicago, and so they made a deal with WGN to bring the games here, and I was able to go along with them, as luck had it.
What do you love about college sports? I mean, obviously it's cool because it's your alma mater, but what do you love about college sports?
Well, Steve, it's changed a lot over the years. I mean, it's when I first started doing it, first of all, not every game was on television, but there was still, and maybe I was a little naive, I still thought there was a certain purity to it that you didn't necessarily see in the pros.
Sure.
Now, what I realize now is some of that's fool's gold. I mean, it's not that pure and it's not that clean, and there's plenty of bad stuff that goes on. But I still think that for most of the kids playing, it is still the idea that they are playing. It's a means to a college education. They love playing the game, even though they're not being paid directly. They're not, in most cases, they're not being handed cash to play it.
Sure.
And I've always enjoyed the whole atmosphere around the college game. I love getting to the stadium early, and it sometimes drives the people I work with on the broadcast a little crazy, because I'll say, hey, let's go. You know, it's I want to get there 3 hours before kickoff and watch the stadium come to life on a Saturday morning.
Watch it fill up and
watch,
all that.
You watch the guys come out to do their warm-ups, and then you watch the band rehearse the national anthem, and slowly you watch the fans begin to trickle in.
That's how you get your game face on.
Yeah, I mean, it's your preparation. I love walking through the parking lot, seeing the tailgaters, the smell of the grills going early in the morning, and to me, it's a cool atmosphere. I've always enjoyed it.
Have you ever gotten tired of it?
I've never gotten tired of it.
So you'll do it as long as you can.
I will do it as long as I can, and you know, people have asked me now. This is going to be 30 years of college football this year, and I started doing it on a year-to-year basis. Basically, I never had more than a one-year deal for the first several years I did it, and now I look at it as I'd like to keep doing it. As long as they would have me do it, and as long as I can. And the thing you worry about, I guess, as you get older is your eyesight going to hold out? And are you going to be able to see what's happening on the field? And I don't want to be one of the guys who sticks around too long.
Right. Well, but you're not even close to that. I want to ask you about this Northwestern atmosphere now. We know the football team's great. We know the basketball team had a rough year, but we know there's a lot of hope there.
Yep.
And a lot of good recruiting, so that takes us to March Madness. Before we get to that, and before we run out of time, you've worked with a ton of legends, ton of them. So I'll throw a name out. Just give me a gut reaction to each one. Harry Carey.
Just so outgoing. And treated me great.
And he didn't treat everybody great. That's no secret.
You know, I started working with Harry over at the other station when he was doing the White Sox, and we were carrying White Sox baseball. And we did an evening sports talk show, which was started in conjunction with the White Sox broadcast. And so Harry would do a half hour leading into the pregame show. He would do it on the phone from the ballpark. I mean, we've come a long way technologically in radio since then. This is back in the early 80s. But on nights where they were in town and the White Sox weren't playing, Harry would come in the studio, and we were on the air from 6:30 to 8. And he would come strolling in, and maybe it had been a day game, and he'd come in from Old Comiskey Park, and he'd bring somebody with him. And I remember one night he brings in Earl Weaver into the studio. And there's a kid who worked as our producer, sort of a gopher for us. And he says, "Hey, kid, come here." And he pulls out a 20 or whatever. And he says, "Go across the street and get a six-pack of Budweiser." And sure enough, I mean, they're sitting there in the studio just pounding buds. He and Earl Weaver.
Telling baseball
stories. And I was just a fly on the wall there, just enjoying it.
How great was that?
It was wonderful. It was great.
Now, the absolute flip side of that was a guy named Jack Brickhouse. I mean, this guy was a broadcaster, right?
He was. And I'd gotten to know Jack a little bit before I worked at GN, where I did some all-star stuff for CBS. And I remember calling him up and a little bit, you know, just not apologetically, but just I was a little nervous. I called him up and asked if he would do this interview that for CBS Radio for the All-Star game. And he not only would he do it, he would come over to our studios and tape it. And so I was just really impressed by that. He took as much time as I needed, and then he said, "Are you sure, kid? You sure you got everything you want there?"
Wow.
And of course, then within a couple of years, I was working with him, and in my mind, everybody who worked at in WGN Radio Sports then worked for him. And he did an evening show on GN, which along with Chuck Swirsky and we had a staff of people producing it, but I would help produce that show and do reports for it. It was the original WGN Sports Central.
What about the Chicago sports legends, guys like Ditka and Jordan? Those guys a little bit were, you know, in their own level of their atmosphere, but any special memories about either one of those
guys?
Well,
because I traveled with the Bears in 85, and so I got to know Ditka when he came to town, and I was covering the Bears some in 84 for GN, and he was still coming on with Wally, even though the games were on the other station.
Oh, really?
And he would still come on. I want to say we carried the Mike Ditka show even before he had the games with Mike Pyle as the co-host.
And, okay.
But I met Ditka and just introduced myself to him and couldn't have been nicer. And you know, he was once we were doing the games. Then part of my job every week, and this was in 85, was I would walk down to the locker room before the game with Dick Butkus, who would do the Mike Ditka pregame show. So he and it was funny. I've told the story before, but sometimes even Butkus would be a little bit intimidated by Ditka before a game. Because, you know, he had his game face on. But he was always first class to me. I mean, I always Mike was great when we were doing the games.
So Butkus didn't want to upset Mike Ditka.
He was a little careful. But I remember we went up to Ditka's hotel suite in New Orleans to do the pregame show the day of Super Bowl 20. And he was watching the pregame stuff was already on. This is hours and hours before the game. And it was just one of those cool things because both of those guys were so excited because they knew what was going to happen in a few hours at the Superdome. I mean, they knew.
The game was a formality.
At this point, it was a coronation. And they were both just besides themselves. I mean, I'm not sure Ditka was showing as much as Butkus was.
But right.
He was like a little kid. He was so excited.
It had to be nothing but fun.
Oh, yeah.
You've had a pretty good run, haven't you?
No complaints here. Yeah. I mean, I've you know, and let me say this too. I've also worked with all of these morning hosts on GN, mm-hmm. going back to Wally,
Bob,
and
Spike.
Bob and Spike, and other guys in between. John was in there briefly for
Williams,
a while, and Greg Jarrett and Johnny B, who I had nothing but fun with. Johnny B. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, people talk about him. He wasn't here very long, but. But he was great to me, and now the opportunity to work with you every morning, I just have a blast.
Oh, we have a good time.
And you know, I think that the thing that you guys have in common, you and Bob and Spike, is that you really use the other people on the show, and you make us all feel a part of it. And I think that's a skill, and it's a talent that sometimes gets lost in this business.
One piece of advice for the kids, because if you get asked about this once a week, you get asked 57 times. The business has changed. The way you get in, the way you break in, the way you get to the gig that turns into the next gig, it's different now. And it's also different than when you got in and when I got in. Every kid wants to be in sports now. So how does a kid get noticed?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. I think there are plenty of opportunities now that weren't there. I mean, when you and I started, you pretty much, at least if you looked at a market like Chicago, you had
to work your way.
You
up.
Had a handful of stations, and you only nobody was really paying attention to the FM. It was all about the AM powerhouse stations, and of those, maybe three or four hired sports people.
Yeah.
You know, so
very narrow path.
And there weren't, if you weren't doing play-by-play for a particular team, that it's not like all the stations had regular sports staffs. So from the standpoint of there's more opportunity now when you look at all of the cable outlets, you look at Big Ten Network, you look at the all sports stations. Those weren't avenues.
And all the web pages.
And all the websites and the bar stools and the Bleacher Reports, yep. and on and on. So I think from that standpoint, you have to be open to not necessarily working for WGN or you name it, but maybe you do start out, you know, try working for one of the websites or the cable-based web, the content providers.
You know,
there are a number of those now that have done very well, and it's a great way to be on the air, so to speak, and to cut your teeth in the business.
Yeah, and I've told kids all the time, write every day,
mm-hmm.
Shoot video of yourself every day, because video and audio are interchangeable now, and continue to do it because it's all about the reps, and continue to ask. And if you wake up in the morning, and the first thing you think about, other than the girl or the boy that you're chasing, is sports, then you know it's your dream. And don't take no for an answer. Chase it. But keep asking, keep applying, keep sending out emails, keep sending out ask someone who knows someone who they could contact on your behalf, and eventually you'll get in.
I would totally agree with you on that. And the other thing I would say is you're going to have to, if you're working in Chicago or you're working in Peoria or wherever you're working, you're going to have to pay your dues. And you're going to have to be willing to take the shifts that nobody else wants to work. And sometimes, you know, it's going to cut into your social life or your spring break. But if you're willing to make that sacrifice, that's a great starting point for you. And the other stuff, if you've got it, if you've got the passion for it, the other stuff will take care of itself.
Hey, your dad and my dad work for a living. You and I never have had to do that.
Nope, thankfully.
Very lucky. Yeah. All right, before we run out of time, it's March Madness time. I know it's early, and depending on when you hear this, March Madness may already be over.
Mm-hmm. Can we go back and edit if
yes,
it's over?
Yes, we can. But we're recording this before, just after the seeds have been dropped. Everybody likes Duke. If it's not Duke, who is it?
If it's not Duke, I think it will be North Carolina.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think if... Look, the odds are everybody loves to say, well, you know, this year maybe a 12 seed will get to the Final Four. Maybe we'll have another Loyola this year that will come onto the scene and just captivate the nation. And there probably will be a team that does that. Maybe it'll be a Wofford or somebody or Vermont or somebody will get hot in the play and make a run. But realistically, two number one seeds made it last year. Two number one seeds, I think, made it the year before. More often than not, a number one seed is going to end up winning it.
That's why they're number one.
So I would say if you look at the Final Four, if you look at the four number one seeds, I would say Duke and North Carolina look to be the best two mm-hmm. of those. Mm-hmm. So you think if Duke, and they're a 2-1 favorite, if they don't get it, there will be Carolina. But I'm not sure that Duke isn't going to get a battle from Michigan State. And I'm not sure that anyone's going to stop Zion Williamson and Duke. But I would say that, you know, you look at Michigan State and they always seem to be ready for those big moments. And I am also not sure that a couple other Big Ten teams, including Michigan, won't at least make a run and be heard from. Now, they would have to get past Gonzaga in the West. But I think that's possible. So
you just made Super Joe's day by saying Michigan could beat Gonzaga.
I didn't even see him sitting there.
Super Joe, you get the last question. Is there anything you always wanted to ask Dave Ennett that you've never asked him before?
So you've had a ton of highlights, and I've always wondered, how do you come up with your touchdown call, with your game-winning shot call? Is that something that's that you think up of beforehand, or is it just kind of natural?
Well, first of all, I've never had a really catchphrase per se. Other than the Wildcats win when they do, because those are words that at least the fans of the program like to hear. I don't think you can script stuff out. I mean, I've had some milestone moments where something's happened, a record's been broken, something like that, or a dramatic. I've probably called as many dramatic wins, overtime games, as anybody has had the fortune to call, just because that's how they've played.
Yeah.
And so I don't think you can plan those things out. I think you just have to go with it in the moment. I mean, I go back to the call in 2017, the basketball play with Nathan Taphorn to Derek Pardon.
Yeah.
Look, you're looking at that situation. There's a fraction of a second on the clock. They got to throw the ball all the way down the court. The guy's got to catch it and then score. The odds of that play working, even though teams try it all the time.
100-1.
Yeah. And so you're kind of looking at it. You're already thinking in your mind, okay, got to get ready for the start of overtime here. And all of a sudden you see it developing, and it's sort of that slow motion, the end of Hoosiers, the shot going in,
sure.
and it's like, oh my gosh, this is about to happen. And so all you could do is react naturally, and that's all I've ever tried to do.
You got a one you do at your house, Super Joe? You got one you do in the car? Your own catchphrase?
No, I don't really have a catchphrase. I feel like the guys that I've listened to, the guys that I've watched, that it kind of just comes naturally.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of hawk in my, you know, play-by-play, I guess. I got one more question for Dave.
Yeah, go ahead.
Whether it's in your wheelhouse or not, you know, whether it's Northwestern sports or not, what's your dream event to call?
Dream event to call? Well, I think that is, it's probably both, and it would be, well, let me say this. For a long time, I wanted to do Bears games, and when I was working with Joe McConnell and Wayne Larrivee on Bears sure. broadcasts, I mean, that was always sort of a goal of mine. That ship sailed a long time ago, and I certainly have loved every minute of my association with Northwestern. I would love the opportunity, and I believe that this may happen in the next few years. We saw Northwestern playing the Big Ten championship game this past year. I think they'll get to the college football playoff.
I think so, too.
Might not be next year. Might not be 2 years. It could be 3 years down the road. But I would like to call Northwestern football in the college football playoff.
The Final Four.
Yeah, somewhere there. And also basketball in the Final Four. I'd take either of those right now. Sign me up.
Yeah, no kidding. Well done by you. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate you doing this.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of stuff. You know, you told me stories I didn't even know. So, I know I make a lot of stuff up, but this is stuff I
know. No, these are all actually true stories.
Yeah, very interesting. I hope you send this to your dad.
I will.
Yeah, do that. It's the Dave Ennett Experience, part of the Steve Cochran Everything Podcast. And the good news for you is we didn't get to the personal questions that are none of my business.
Thanks for that.
Part two coming up.
And you can hear Dave every morning with me, 6 to 10 on the Steve Cochran Show. So listen when you can on 720 WGN. And tell your friends about this podcast. Listen all the time. And subscribe to it through your local subscription service. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on the Steve Cochran Everything Podcast.